So please come with me to Matthew chapter 13, and we're going to look at verses 31 and 32. We're looking at these various parables. And we read another parable Jesus put forth to them, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed, which a man took and sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of all the seeds, but when it is grown, is greater than the herbs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and nest in its branches." Well, if you remember, Matthew 13 is in Matthew's Gospel, and it's dealing with a particular theme that runs right through Matthew's Gospel. Matthew's writing to Jews, and his theme is the kingdom of heaven. And if you remember, the kingdom of heaven is where God reigns. It's where his will is done. And the Jews are waiting for the kingdom of heaven to come. They're waiting for God's reign to break in upon the earth. How do they expect the kingdom to come? What was their expectation? Yeah, what were the ingredients in the coming of the kingdom in the Jewish mind? He's going to come as a king, and therefore, you know what we said? They're expecting, that's right, they're expecting when God's intervention comes, when the kingdom of heaven comes, it will be dramatic. Because the king will come, and he will defeat all his and their enemies. He will judge the world. He will, it will be the banquet to which he'll invite his people. And it'll be a renewed, restored Israel, and all those kaleidoscope of images from the Old Testament. When they're expecting that God's kingdom will come in a dramatic, cosmic, sudden way. But of course, how does the kingdom of heaven come? That's right, it comes very softly. It's progressive. You might even describe it as mundane. The kingdom of heaven has come and is coming, is Matthew's point. It's been inaugurated, so it's begun, but it's yet to be consummated. The Jews believe that if this is the old age, the age of sin and all that goes on, when God would intervene, the kingdom of heaven, it would be the end of the old age and it would be the beginning of a new age. That's what they believed. So it's going to be dramatic and cosmic, isn't it? Because it's the end of the old order. Everything changes. You can never go back to what it was. But of course, what Matthew is showing them is that when the kingdom of heaven comes, the old age carries on. The new age begins, but for a time, the two ages overlap. So the Jews said, you know, when the kingdom of heaven comes, it'll be the defeat of all our enemies. Jesus says, on the contrary, far from you being free, they're going to slap you on the cheek and you have to turn the other cheek. And we've looked at the parable of the sower, we've looked at the parable of the wheat and the tares, and they're looking at the fact that the kingdom, when it comes progressively, it comes often quietly. It's not dramatic, explosive, cosmic, and its coming isn't the end of the old age. The two ages overlap. And there's this expression, it's the already, well, my writing's terrible, the already but not yet. It's come and it's coming. It's come, but it's not yet being consummated. And that was shocking to the Jewish mind. They'd never heard or thought of it like that ever. So Matthew is writing primarily to Jews to resolve in their mind this tension between what they're expecting and fulfillment. Expectation and fulfillment, okay? And all the parables fit into that scheme. The already but not yet. So, parable of the mustard seed. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed which a man took, sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of the seeds, but when it has grown, it is greater than the herbs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and nest in its branches. There are two thoughts going on there. I'm going to say a few things, and then we'll open up for some discussion and comment. Two things going on there. The parable emphasizes a contrast, doesn't it? It's a mustard seed. It's the least of the seeds. It's something so tiny, you wouldn't even know you had it in your hand. And yet, when it germinates and grows, it outgrows all the other herbs and becomes so big it gets called a tree. So you have the least of the seeds, the tiniest of the seeds, becoming the greatest of the herbs, or even bigger than the herbs. It becomes bigger than a bush, it becomes a tree. So it's emphasizing the contrast. From the least to the greatest, from something that's inconspicuous to something that's conspicuous, something that is missable, or maybe you would dismiss it, to something that's completely unmissable. The second thought about the parable is growth. So the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed which a man took and sowed in his field. That's the description. Then we're told about it, which is the least of all the seeds. But when it is grown, it becomes greater than the herbs. And there you have it. It's the least, but it becomes greater. That's the contrast. But you get from the least to the greater by the fact it grows. So those are two things it's bringing out. It's bringing out the contrast between how it begins and how it ends. And it's pointing out the reason you get from the how it begins and how it ends is because it grows. That's the parable. It's about growth. Okay. Well, let's fire some questions out. Have I got a cloth here at all? Don't worry, I've got a paper tissue. Okay, some questions. We're told the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. It grows, becomes greater than herbs, becomes a tree. What in biblical terms is the significance of a tree? Where do you come across trees, particularly thinking about the Old Testament? Because this is Jews, they're very well versed in the Old Testament. Don't worry, you can have all sorts of trees. I'm not saying anyone's a right tree or a wrong tree, but there is a particular focus to trees. Garden of Eden, tree in the Garden of Eden, yeah. Okay, yeah. So, go on. Yeah. So you got the tree. Jonah's good. Daniel, yeah, do you want to go on a bit more? Nebuchadnezzar? You're spot on. Let's go to Daniel chapter 4. Remember, he has a vision, doesn't he? He has a dream. And he says, chapter 4, verse 10, I was looking and behold a tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew and became strong. Its height reached the heavens. It could be seen to the ends of the earth. Its leaves were lovely, its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it. The birds of the heavens dwelt in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. Now, Daniel will give the interpretation. Who is the tree? Or what is the tree? Nebuchadnezzar. And obviously, Nebuchadnezzar's a man, but Nebuchadnezzar's the head of an empire, isn't he? So, it is Nebuchadnezzar because he is head of the Babylonian Empire. He personally is not a tree, but as the king of this huge empire, that's how it's represented. So you get the description, Daniel, verse 20. It says, the tree that you saw, which grew and became strong, whose height reached to the heavens, and which could be seen by all the earth, whose leaves were lovely and its fruit abundant, in which was food for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and in whose branches the birds of heaven had their home. It is you, O King, who have grown and become strong, for your greatness has grown and reaches to the heavens, and your dominion, your rule, your kingdom, to the end of the earth. What happens to the tree in the vision? It's cut down. The tree is cut down. That's right. Which is spoken of in verses 14 and 15. And it's fulfilled, isn't it? In verse 30, the king spoke, saying, is this not great Babylon that I have built for my royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honour of my majesty? While the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it has been spoken, the kingdom has departed from you. The tree is cut down. The kingdom departs from him. So, Old Testament, a tree symbolizes a kingdom, or symbolizes the king over the kingdom. Now, of course, the kingdom is restored to Nebuchadnezzar, isn't it? His sanity returns. He submits himself to God. Ultimately, though, the Babylonian tree doesn't last. It gets chopped down anyway, finally, because it gets replaced by the empire of the Medes and Persians. It's succeeded by other empires. And you get the words in chapter 4, verse 17, where it's talking about the decision to cut down the tree. This decision is by the decree of the watchers and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. So a tree symbolizes empire. Trees can get chopped down. This tree gets chopped down because empires come to an end. Because God decides who rules. God decides which empires prevail. God decides how long those empires exist for. He gives the empires to whomever he wish. And the time comes when the trees are chopped down. He rules. If we had time, we could look at Ezekiel 31, where again the Assyrian Empire is described as a tree. And the Egyptian Empire, when it's being written, when Ezekiel is speaking, he speaks of the Assyrian Empire as having been chopped down. And then he says to Egypt, your tree, your empire, is also going to be chopped down. So, tree, for tree, read empire. Okay? What about the birds? What the birds? In the parable of the sower, parable of the mustard seed, the birds come and nestle in the branches. Is that just there to say, well, it gets so big that even birds can nest in it? What's the significance of birds in this same sort of paradigm? The bird sign finds security in the tree. So within our picture of a tree being an empire, what are the birds? Yeah, people. It's explained, isn't it, in verses 21 and 22. It talks about the birds, the animals coming and under the tree for shelter, and the birds of heaven find their home in it. It's you, O King, who have grown and become strong, for your greatness has grown and reaches to the heavens, and your dominion to the end of the earth. So it's saying that the nations have come under the shade of the Babylonians, under the shade of Nebuchadnezzar, for security, for safety. It's such a big empire that the nations feel safe under this empire. They nestle in the branches. They come under Nebuchadnezzar for shade and security. Okay? So that's just simply looking at Old Testament. Old Testament, trees equal empire. Birds that come and nest in trees represent nations coming to the tree for security and safety. Okay, so how does all that apply to the parable of the mustard seed? The Gentile. So just rewind a bit. What is the tree? What is the mustard seed becomes a tree? What's the empire it's speaking of? It's speaking of the kingdom of heaven. So the kingdom of heaven is likened to a tree because it's an empire. And as you say, the nations that come under the birds that come and nest in the trees are the nations. All the nations will come and find security and safety in the kingdom of heaven. So the kingdom of heaven, its beginnings are tiny, like a mustard seed, but it will grow to become greater than the herbs and becomes a tree, so that the birds of the air come and nest in its branches. The kingdom of heaven will grow to conquer the nations. How far does the growing and conquering go? How extensive is this empire? It goes to the ends of the earth. And ultimately, the ends of the earth is the ultimate destination, but do you want to just fill it out with a bit more information? Yes, it'll be the whole renewed universe. So Revelation 21 and 22. Excuse me, Revelation 21. it's talking about a new heaven and new earth. And we take it up 21 verse 24. It's talking about the church. It's talking about the new heavens and new earth. And it says, and the nations of those who are saved shall walk in his light, and the kings of the earth shall bring their glory and honor into it. Verse 26, and they shall bring the glory and honor of the nations into it. Chapter 22. Verse 2, and the leaves of the trees were for the healing of the nations. I know that's the tree of life, but it's the fact that the nations are there. So, the kingdom of heaven, from its tiny beginnings, is going to grow until eventually it fills the whole renewed universe. And in it will be found the nations. People out of every tribe, kindred, nation and tongue are going to be in the kingdom of heaven. It'll be filled with the redeemed of the nations. Now, of course, that begs another question. What about all those who aren't the redeemed of the nations? What do we describe them as? And we could discuss that maybe another time. Okay, so how does the parable help the Jews with this already, with this, they've got this view that it's going to take place like that. Matthew's saying, no, it takes place like that. How does the parable help them to work it through?
It connects an Old Testament idea with a New Testament way of thinking. So, they, as you said, they can already relate to the tree imagery. But if they follow the logic of what a tree does through, then they will see that a tree doesn't just spring up overnight.
Yes, yes.
So if the imagery of the Old Testament is true and faithful, then they shouldn't expect a seed using the word.
That's right. They've been reading their Old Testament through sort of lenses, haven't they, which have blocked out anything that doesn't fit in with their way of thinking. And actually what it's saying is, the parable of the mustard seed is saying that actually this is thoroughly, completely rooted in Old Testament thinking of empires that take time to grow and develop and come to fruition. So it's completely Jewish thinking. So that's a surprise to them, isn't it? And it's saying, isn't it, that trees take time to grow, empires take time to grow, they have small beginnings, and they grow to a great extent. So it's saying, isn't it, the kingdom of heaven ultimately will be an all-conquering kingdom. It will be cosmic in its dimensions. But its beginnings, like the beginnings of all empires, like the beginnings of a tree, are going to be very small, inconspicuous, you wouldn't even know it was there. And also, as a tree grows, as the mustard seed grows, it's saying that the kingdom comes progressively. Expect it to get bigger and bigger and grow and advance, until it ultimately outgrows all other kingdoms. and it'll be the kingdom that outlasts all the other kingdoms. But for a time, expect the kingdoms to overlap. It won't necessarily be the dominant kingdom till right at the end. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. So you've got the two things there. It's the contrast, tiny beginnings, great tree at the end. That's the kingdom of heaven, a tiny beginning, all-conquering empire at the end. And you've got the whole thing of growth, that it doesn't just simply happen like that, as the Jews are expecting. It'll grow, it'll come progressively, it'll get bigger and bigger and advance. Okay. All those things being said, how might Christ's coming be described as a mustard seed? If we start at the beginning, how might we describe Christ's coming as a mustard seed? You start off as a baby. All right, that's a starting point. Lots. Yep, so Bethlehem. Inconspicuous, tiny, no one notices Bethlehem. Nazareth, yep, so it grows up in Nazareth. Can anything good come out of Nazareth?
Carpenter's son.
Carpenter's son, yep. And actually becomes a carpenter in his own right, yep. What else is mustard seed about it? There's loads of things. Yep, so how should I write that up, Mickey? Not impressive to look at. So ordinary, yeah? no comeliness, that's right. So ordinary looking. This looks ordinary. This just looks like anyone else. Nothing to make... Sorry? Poor, yep. What did he say particularly to point out his poverty? Do you remember what he says? Yeah, foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. He's got no publicity machine behind him. He's got no big wealthy backers. He's got nothing behind him. Absolutely nothing. Not even a place to lay his head. So what else could we say?
His disciples are very ordinary.
Yep, absolutely. Ordinary disciples. And they are very ordinary, aren't they? Ordinary working men. And actually, lots of them in John 6 desert him, don't they? They say, oh, if you're going to teach like that, we can't put up with that. That's not what we're in here for. So they leave him.
He also hangs around with undesirables.
Yep, so undesirables. I mean, where does he begin his ministry? That's sort of very off-putting. Where does he begin?
Galilee,
that's right, yes. And it's of course, it's as they think of it, it's Galilee of the Gentiles. Isn't it? It's a very mixed area. So he's with undesirables, he's with sinners, Galilee of the Gentiles. What other things does he do which are all mustard seed-like? Sorry? Yeah, I'll come to that at the end, if I may. You're absolutely right, I completely agree with that. I'm just working through his life at the moment. Yeah, so few converts. That's interesting, isn't it? Probably Peter had more converts on the day of Pentecost than Christ had throughout his ministry. Chose to be an unsuccessful preacher. It's not very impressive, this, is it? It's all mustard seed-like, you see. Anything else? He undesirables, but also there's sick, the infirm... Sinners, they're all people that are not going to get you terribly far in this world, are they?
He grew.
Yep, okay, that's very helpful. Yep, so he's growing. So he's gone from a baby to having an influence and a ministry, and it's growing. Yep, so how can I put that in two words? No publicity. Should we say that?
Actively disliked by a lot of people with influence.
Yep, so actively despised I was going to say by the great and the good, but that's not quite by VIPs. Let's do it like that. This very chapter 13, what's he doing in chapter 13? This goes against this publicity thing. What's happening in chapter 13? Speaking in parables, what do parables do?
Hide the message.
They hide the message, don't they? We'll come back to that later in the series. They hide the message. Just when he gets a big following, he starts speaking to them in riddles. You can imagine a political party, can't you? I mean, you know, UKIP, they're getting going, and then Nigel Farage starts to, with a pint in his hand, starts to talk to them in riddles, and no one can understand a word he's saying. What's it on about? He threw it all away, wouldn't they? But Christ, when he gets a big following, it's only when he starts getting a big following that then he starts talking to them in riddles. So most of people walk away and say, what was all that about? I don't understand it. It's all mustard seed, isn't it? So, no publicity, so parables is all part of that. Okay, let's move nearer then to the cross. Let's move up to, what about the week before the cross? What does he do?
Donkey,
that's right. So he comes in Jerusalem on a donkey. And it's a colt of a donkey, isn't it? So if you're a grown man and you're sitting on a colt, a young donkey, where are your feet going to be? They're almost going to be touching the ground, aren't they? You're not coming in riding high. Actually, if you sit on a donkey, most people, you're going to be shorter than most people around you. And that's a triumphant entry. Very strange, isn't it? Okay, let's go on. Anything else? Going into let's go into the last few hours then, before the cross. Yeah. So he washes their feet. It's a funny thing for a king to do, isn't it? Yeah. So Gethsemane, where he's vehement cries and tears. What's happened before Gethsemane? He's been betrayed, isn't he? So one of his own men, has betrayed him. And what's going to happen to the rest of them very soon? They'll flee, they'll run. Yeah, the rest flee. And his right-hand man, Peter, is actually going to deny him. You come then to the cross. He's going to die a slow, agonizing death. And who's going to abandon him at the end?
Everyone.
And ultimately his father. He's cursed and abandoned by his father. What does it say? It says, the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed which a man took and sowed in his field, which indeed is the least of all the seeds. He is the least, isn't he? If ever a man lived and was the least, it's him. By any scale, by any reckoning, he is the least of all who have ever lived. Because at the end, he's even cursed and abandoned by God himself. The least of all the seeds. And you look at that and you say, well, that man, that king, is never ever going to conquer the world. That ends in failure. Complete, abject failure. But of course, what happens? You have resurrection. You have ascension. You have coronation. Where is he tonight? That's right, he sits upon the throne of God. He's at the Father's right hand. He's been exalted to the place of all authority and power. And that's why I just flip back to Daniel. We looked at Daniel 4, verse 17. And we're told the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. So God will give the kingdom to the lowest of men, to the least of men. Turn over a couple of pages to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel 7, verse 13. I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. Now, it's talking there about Christ after his ascension. It's talking about his coronation. Where it says he's coming with the clouds of heaven, is he's not coming from God to this world. It's not talking about his second coming. He's coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days. He's coming to the Father. So this is Christ after his resurrection, his ascension. He comes to heaven and he comes to the Father. They brought him. And because he was the only man who never sought anything for himself, because he was the only man who lived wholly, completely, utterly in obedience to the Father. Because he was the only man who perfectly lived as Adam should have lived. Because he is the only man who ever was worthy. God the Father therefore gives to him the kingdom. And having received the kingdom, we're told, it's an everlasting dominion. It shall not pass away. His kingdom, the one which shall not be destroyed. So from these mustard seed beginnings, it's going to grow. The contrast between being abandoned by the Father and now the Father giving him the kingdom. The contrast, the growth, the contrast, the growth is what it's emphasizing. So his kingdom is going to come. It's going to come with power. It's going to outlast all the other kingdoms. It is the kingdom which will never be defeated. It's the one that ultimately will conquer all. And Christ will reign as king. And in the advancement of his kingdom, the nations, the redeemed of the nations, will be brought to Christ. They will find their safety and security under this king. And the day is coming when his kingdom will extend over the whole universe, the whole renewed universe, and his people will dwell under the shade of their king in perfect happiness and joy and delight. And that's what the parable's saying. The crucified is now at God's right hand. That's the contrast. The growth from such tiny beginnings, from here to a teenage mother, to this glorious, wonderful outcome, to conquer all. So does that make sense? Yeah? Okay, well, as we close, just a couple of things. How does this parable help us as we think about evangelistic initiatives and matters to pray over in the week of prayer? In the week of prayer, we're thinking about evangelism. We're thinking about pressing the kingdom of God beyond our boundaries, if I'm putting it like that. How does this parable help us as we think about that, as we pray about that, and as we look to formulate our plans and work these things through? Absolutely, Ken. So our beginnings may be very, very small. Because obviously the parable works at a global level, doesn't it? It's a parable that's true of the kingdom of God through all generations. But it's also true at a local level, isn't it? Every time the kingdom of God comes to a new area, there's a sense in which it's beginning as a mustard seed. So beginnings might be very small. So when we come to the week of prayer, some of the ideas people have talked about, some of the initiatives and so on, they may seem very unimpressive. They may seem very small. You may look at it and think, well, that's not going to change anything. And actually, as we think about things, we may feel as we begin to embark upon things, we may feel that our contacts, our opportunities, our situations are very small and unimpressive. They're no bigger than a mustard seed. You may find that in a particular area of work, there's really only one child that shows any interest. You may try and evangelize a particular area, and only one family gives a positive response. Thousands don't. Maybe even in our dealings with people, we may do something which is very small and apparently inconsequential, but it's a mustard seed. So we might look at somebody. We might smile at somebody. We might welcome somebody. We might give them a friendly hello and start engaging with them. It may be a small act of kindness. It may be just spending time with somebody. And you think, well, what was all that about? That was a waste of time. So, as we come to the week of prayer, brothers and sisters, let's not dismiss any idea or initiative because it doesn't look very impressive, or because it seems small, or because you look at that and think, well, what's that going to do? All right? We must never dismiss tiny beginnings, however unimpressive. And even as we prayed about things, and you think, well, we really prayed about that, and then nothing happened. Nothing happened for a year, 2 years, 3 years. Don't be surprised. Maybe another generation that does the reaping. And that follows on the second bit then, as we think about this. We must never lose heart. Must we? Because we're not looking, this is all a disaster. There's no success here at all. By anyone's measurement, there's no success. And even if you said, well, look, hang on a minute. By the time we get to about, what about when we get to the entrance into Jerusalem? That's lots of people cheering and shouting. But you say, okay, so you've got a little bit of a tree there. Well, it gets chopped down, doesn't it? The tree gets chopped down. So we must never lose heart. Because we're laboring for the kingdom which will never be destroyed. I remember a friend of mine was an engineer, and he said, he's involved in building bridges, and he said, one day, all my bridges are going to be burnt up. They're not going to survive. They're all going to go. But he said, all I do for the Lord in terms of the kingdom, that will survive. Now, we know it's not as... We know that what we do when we build bridges is for the Lord, don't we? Whatever. We all have callings, and I'm to do that with all my heart for the Lord. That's the calling he's given to me. But there's a point there, isn't there? Whatever I do for the kingdom of God, however small, mean it might be, I never need to lose heart. Because it's never, ever in vain. It's done for the Lord. It's done for the kingdom that will never have an end. And I'll just read this to you. This is a prayer letter from Matt Gamston. Matt is serving in the Philippines. He's been out there about 10 years. This is his February prayer letter. It's a sort of mustard seed situation. And he says this. He says, sometimes in the mess of life, it's very hard to see how God is working. Perhaps difficult to believe that he has the power to make new people. And easy to become cynical and discouraged. A few weeks ago, I dug through some old prayer letters to help tell the story of one of the big recent encouragements in the work with the homeless. They work with, it's a church, they work with homeless people in the Philippines. Lots of people just live on the streets and they work with them. So he's just culling things from old prayer letters. So prayer letter, October 2005. It says, this month a new family have started sleeping in the same road as our church building. The mother is sick and has four girls under the age of 10, none of whom go to school. Okay, 2006, a few months later. I have mentioned a few times in my letters about a family who have been living in the same road as our church building. They are a very friendly family, and the kids are so well behaved and always smiling. The family attend the drop-in each week, and the children are regular in Sunday school, and the mother in the beginner's class. Last week we helped pay for them to go back to the island they originally came from. We were hoping they would stay a bit longer to complete the medicine they were taking, but the mother was very keen to leave as soon as possible. In one way, it was very sad, as we were hoping to send the kids to school, and also were encouraged at their spiritual interest. Almira, that's the mother, says that Almira says that she has work waiting for her back in Kibbu, but I wasn't as confident as she was, and the future still seems very uncertain. On the other hand, we are always pleased when we can help street people leave Cubeo and hopefully make a better life for themselves away from all the problems on the streets here. We gave her a Bible, paid for their fares, and pray that God will continue to speak to her and her family. Move on 2 years, 2008. In the same road as our church building, there's a lady who sleeps on the street with her children. In the past, we paid for them to go home to an island in the south of the Philippines, but after a while, she came back. Eventually, it was decided to place the three oldest girls in our children's home temporarily until Amira recovered from illness and send them to school. They're beautiful kids, friendly, clever, always smiling. Then within a year, the mother gets pregnant and a couple of weeks ago gave birth. Then Matt says this, what is the point of helping her if she will continue to be so irresponsible? Are we contributing in any way to the irresponsibility by taking care of her kids? But if we don't help them, then what future have they got? There are success stories, and yet the honest truth is that generally, for every encouragement, there are many more discouragements. Yet somehow, through the mess, we believe that God is working, that God has the power to make new people. 2011 now, so that's 3 years after he wrote that. Most encouraging of all, though, was the baptism of one of our former homeless ladies, Almira, who was contacted through the drop-in centre and then converted through the Monday night Bible study. I was thankful to be able to be at the morning service in Cubeo to witness the baptism. In the past, I can remember feeling enormously discouraged and wondering what the point was, unless she had a change of heart. But in God's mercy, a change of heart is exactly what has happened. Talking to her after the baptism, it was so exciting to hear her testimony and see the difference in her. We then move up to 2013. And last month, two of Almira's children were baptized. Their testimonies tell how hard life was living on the street. And when they first met us and began attending the drop-in center, of hearing the Bible taught many times but never really understanding the gospel, then seeing their mother being baptized and the influence she had on them, encouraging them to listen and no longer allowing them to sleep in the sermons. And as Almira also began to read the Bible with them and explain the gospel to them, little by little they began to understand. Sometimes he says it's so encouraging just to stop and look back and see what God has done. Almira's story is a testimony to the patience and grace of God. And it's encouraging to be reminded that we don't just offer people a system, but a living person who truly brings hope for lasting change. His ways are mysterious and his timing is certainly very different to ours. And yet even in the middle of the messiness of life and with all the doubts and discouragements that sometimes flood upon us, God really is at work and truly does have the power to make new people. It's 8 years from the first meeting to actually then seeing two of the girls baptized. And on the way, all sorts of discouragements and messiness and difficulties. But they stuck at it, didn't they? It was their mustard seed, that first meeting with the family. And then see what God has done. So as we finish this, the parable gives us great encouragement, doesn't it? Never despise tiny beginnings. You might feel, well, what can I do? Well, do what you can do, just to have a friendly greeting to someone. What God might do with that. And never be discouraged, because however small it is what we do. And however it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. Because it's God at work, he's pleased to take a mustard seed, the least, the nothing, and to do wonderful things with it for his glory. So we can take heart, can't we, as we come to the week of prayer, and as we formulate our ideas and plans, as we share them with one another, let's take big heart from these things. And remember, we're praying in the light of this wonderful parable.